Testing for COVID-19 continues, but there are still many questions on whether everyone has access.
The amount of testing that the U.S. is doing is still not enough for the amount of infections that are likely out there, and certainly not enough to meet the demand for testing.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, July 15th, a look at coronavirus testing throughout the United States. Also, how heat waves may cause problems in the fight against COVID-19. And we bring you part of our recent forum on what the future of policing looks like in the United States.
We've got to be real careful that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and that we don't paint with broad brushes. It's truly about leadership.
But we've been measuring crime in law enforcement for the last quarter century. We haven't been measuring justice.
All right, let's do this.
My name is Dan Robertson. I'm calling from Oakland, California. I've been tested 5 times. The soonest I got my results was in 2.5 days. The longest it took for me to get results was a week. I've been negative every time.
This is Julie from Erie, Colorado. I was tested in early March at an urgent care in Boulder, Colorado for COVID. I had to wait in my car for 4.5 hours. The nurse at the urgent care barely swabbed the inside of my nostril. I don't feel like the test was done correctly, but I can't confirm that.
My name is Kim Gilio from Sarasota, Florida. My son-in-law had the COVID test a couple weeks ago, and it was painful. Pretty much tried to suck out his brain. Anyway, that wasn't the worst part. The worst part, it was waiting 6 or 7 days before he got his results. That's just unacceptable. And by the way, they live with me. So what we had to do for those 6 or 7 days, put him on the other side of the house and completely stay away from him.
As the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases rises across much of the southern and western United States, testing remains a critical piece of state and federal efforts to slow the spread of the virus. But in many parts of the country, testing sites and labs are struggling to meet an increased demand, resulting in long lines in states like Texas, Florida, and California. Some people have had to wait hours in the sweltering summer heat to get tested, while others have been turned away entirely. And people aren't just seeing delays in waiting to get tested. It can take days, sometimes weeks, to get your results and to find out if you're positive for COVID-19. That slow turnaround might just undermine other efforts to stop the spread of the virus in the U.S., things like contact tracing and self-isolation of those who've been infected. I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're talking testing today on The Takeaway. Matthew Perrone is with me. He's a health reporter for the Associated Press. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
And Jennifer Nuzzo is on the line. She's the lead epidemiologist for the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 Testing Insights Initiative. Jennifer, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, can you give us the national picture here? How would you characterize U.S. testing right now? Is there a strategy?
Well, unfortunately, there is not a strategy. We've made great progress despite that fact. We've really greatly increased the amount of tests that are being done in the United States from somewhere under 30,000 in mid-March to well over 600,000 in recent weeks. So this is important progress, but unfortunately, the spread of the virus has outpaced these efforts, and the amount of testing that the U.S. is doing is still not enough for the amount of infections that are likely out there, and certainly not enough to meet the demand for testing. So the absence of a strategy has really hindered this, because essentially we've left it up to 50 different states to figure out how best to address the testing needs, which in many instances has been slowed by global gaps in testing supplies.
Supplies and also labs themselves are backed up, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's really been interesting. We're hearing about a lot of different types of bottlenecks, but we haven't actually done a national audit of testing to understand exactly what the issues are. There's certainly been reports about shortages in the chemicals that they use to process the tests, shortages in pipettes, which is just another supply, and sometimes shortages in the swabs they use to take specimens. We've also heard that just labs just simply can't keep up with the volume, and that's possibly a personnel shortage. But we really need to do a national assessment to figure out exactly what the country's bottlenecks are and to figure out how best to address them.
Matthew, when we talk about testing, Jennifer mentioned some of the different kinds, but can you help us understand how many different types of tests are there right now?
for the vast, vast majority of people out there right now, there's really only one test that is going to matter to them. That's, as you said, the nasal swab. The scientific acronym is PCR, but it's really a genetic test. And that's so important because that's going to tell you whether you have an active infection right now, which is what most people want to know. The antibody tests are something different. That will tell you if you were exposed to the virus at some point in the past, if you fought it off, that's why your body made the antibodies. But I think it's important for people to understand that right now we can't really do anything useful. The average person can't really do anything useful with that information. That's because we don't know yet whether having those antibodies makes you immune from COVID-19, whether it's going to prevent you from being reinfected, from infecting others. They're just more unknowns than knowns about antibody tests right now. So really what we need to concern ourselves with are those genetic tests, largely the nasal swabs.
And Matthew, there's been some talk also about at-home tests and rapid testing. Those are also testing for whether or not someone has COVID-19, not necessarily the antibodies, but are they useful and are they in large supply?
The FDA has authorized a handful of at-home tests, mostly saliva-based. You know, they basically send you a tube, you fill it with some saliva, you ship it back to a lab. They aren't available in large supplies. For a long time, they've been limited in some cases to healthcare providers. So they are a useful technology. I think everyone hopes that they'll become more widely available. But for the kind of, you know, mass testing that we need to do right now to address these long lines you're seeing across the country, unfortunately, at-home testing is not going to address that right now.
How accurate are these tests?
It really depends on which kind of test you get. And one of the challenges is that the performance of these tests hasn't been evaluated in operational use. So when companies that make them try to demonstrate their performance in order to get authorization to use them, they use basically lab specimens and compare the test results to what they know the lab specimens contain. But that's much different than when a specimen is obtained in operational settings, or, you know, a healthcare provider puts a swab up your nose and tries to obtain a specimen and then ship that specimen off to a laboratory to perform the test. And so we don't really have a great sense of how these tests perform in real-world settings. That said, if you get a positive test result, you should believe that positive test result. There's potentially a larger problem with the test, and to what extent this is a problem likely depends on the technology, where you may get a negative that may not be a true negative. That could be just because you were tested too early, which is not really the fault of the test, but it could also just be that they didn't get a great specimen, or perhaps there was not enough sensitivity of the test that was being run.
Jennifer, what does it mean to be tested too early?
Yeah, so I think this is actually something that people don't expect when we talk about the importance of getting tested. Depending on where you are in your course of your illness, you could test today and be negative, but then test today and be positive. And it just may take more time for you to express enough virus for the test to pick it up. And this is, I think, important for people who may go out to get tested just to kind of see if they have it. That's not necessarily all you know if you test negative that day is that you don't have it that day, but you could very well become contagious the next day.
Interesting. Matthew, we talked a little bit about the long lines. We interviewed Mayor Kate Gallego yesterday about the long lines that she's seeing in Phoenix, Arizona, where people are just, in some instances, really being affected by the heat. There were some really strict criteria initially for people who wanted to get tested. And now I'm wondering if those criteria are still in place. I know here in New York, Matthew, we hear television ads all the time encouraging New Yorkers to get tested, but can anyone get tested?
Yeah, it really depends on where you are. And you're right. In the early days of the virus, of the outbreak, the CDC recommended from the top down that these tests should be reserved for people with symptoms, people in healthcare settings like hospitals, nursing homes, really trying to conserve the tests for the people that need them most. That's really changed now. We've realized a lot of the disease spread now is happening from younger people, people who may not even have symptoms, asymptomatic people. So what you're seeing is increased testing, broadening those guidelines to try and catch more of those people. You know, the downside is that we're going to have to test a much larger group of people. But we still have, as we've been talking about, many of the underlying bottlenecks and supply challenges that have been plaguing us since the earliest days of the virus. So it's as if, you know, we've built this bigger house, this testing infrastructure, but it's still trying to stand on these kind of shaky foundations of limited testing kits, limited testing chemicals, and limited personnel to perform the tests.
Matthew, how much do tests cost? Because again, in New York, we see advertisements for getting COVID-19 testing, and they say it's free. And yet I'm hearing from people who are saying it's not free. So is it free? Is it not free? Does it depend on where you get tested or what state you get tested?
Congress has passed a law under one of the pandemic stimulus bills that basically mandates that insurers cover testing. So by law, these are supposed to be covered by insurance. However, what you're seeing is that there can be ancillary costs when you go to get tested. They might have to run other tests. They might have to perform other types of care, and those won't necessarily be covered. So you do have these reports of people who went to get tested and are winding up with bills in the hundreds, sometimes even thousands, because they've been hit with these costs separate from the actual COVID-19 testing itself.
Jennifer, I want to go back to what you were saying about when someone gets tested. I mean, is there an optimal time for someone to decide when to get tested? Even because not only are we talking about waiting online, but the results that you get depending on when you get tested could be misleading. So it should. What should people be thinking about if they want to go and get tested?
First, the most obvious time is that if you are feeling like you have symptoms, it's important to get tested as soon as possible, because you want to know if you have the virus so that you can take protective measures so that you don't infect others. It may not come back positive at that point, and it would be important to also talk to a healthcare provider to decide if a repeat test is necessary. Certainly, if you go to get tested because you think you have COVID-19, you should absolutely stay home and not interact with others until you get your test results, which with increasing testing delays may be a challenge, but it very much won't help if people just continue to go about their lives, potentially exposing others until they get those test results. But for people without symptoms, it's a little bit less clear. And this is one of the challenges as we think about expanding tests. Certainly, if you have been exposed to a known COVID-19 case, it is also important that you limit your interactions so that you don't potentially infect others in case you too have become infected. But you may go and be tested and be negative, but you shouldn't necessarily assume that that means you're in the clear. Increasingly, health authorities are encouraging people to stay at home, even with a negative test, for a certain number of days until we can be sure that people who have been identified as close contacts of COVID cases, that they can, you know, stay home for a period of time until we know for sure that they're not contagious.
Jennifer Nuzzo is the lead epidemiologist for the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 Testing Insights Initiative. And Matthew Perrone is a health reporter for the Associated Press. Matthew and Jennifer, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Pete from West Palm Beach, Florida, calling in regards to COVID. I tested positive on June 22nd. I had about 36 hours of symptoms, night sweats, chills, muscle aches, a little bit of a tightness in my chest. The symptoms went away. I feel pretty much back to normal now. So I still test positive last week. I have not been contacted for contact tracing, and I have not received a letter.
As heat waves make their way across the United States, a lot of people are taking shelter indoors. And that's putting a spotlight on indoor air quality and how it might be contributing to the spread of the coronavirus. According to the National Weather Service, heat is also the deadliest form of extreme weather, putting stress on hospitals and compounding the challenges in fighting COVID-19 and testing for the virus. To find out how, we spoke to Umair Irfan, staff writer at Vox, covering climate change and science. Earlier in the pandemic, some people were hoping that the warmer weather would actually help reduce the transmission of COVID-19. And here's what Umair told me about that.
Well, no, that has not really held up. We also got some pretty early indications that it wouldn't hold up because we saw outbreaks in warmer parts of the world. And now we're seeing that play out in the U.S. with some of the hottest parts of the country seeing the most severe outbreaks.
And there's parts of the country that are also experiencing heat waves. How has that made it more difficult to handle the pandemic right now, the extreme heat?
There's a number of different ways. One is that under extreme heat, people spend less time outdoors, more time indoors. And it's in those enclosed environments where COVID-19 has the greatest chance of transmission, particularly among households where you have people living in close proximity. Other factors include things like building surge capacity for hospitals. For instance, when they are dealing with potentially overwhelmed emergency rooms or ICU units, it becomes much harder to build things like outdoor clinics or temporary facilities when you have to do that in the heat. And then also you have to keep those facilities air conditioned.
We've been interviewing mayors from across the country where they are experiencing peaks in coronavirus cases. And one of those was in Phoenix, Arizona, where the mayor there told us that there were people who were waiting for hours in 100 plus degree temperature to get tested. Tell us about what those experiences have been like for folks in terms of access to testing.
Right. It's important to remember that heat on its own is a dangerous health threat. I mean, according to the National Weather Service, heat is the deadliest weather-related phenomenon in the United States. And Maricopa County, the area that encompasses Phoenix, they see roughly about 100 heat-related fatalities a year. So it's already an issue that they have to deal with on an ongoing basis. Now, coupled with the pandemic that's putting all these stresses on infrastructure, and then, as you noted, people waiting in line for things like testing, that bottleneck has compounded the risk of both COVID and heat, and together that is adding more stress to the healthcare system.
As we continue to learn about the coronavirus, there's new information about how it spreads, and there's some reports saying that coronavirus is airborne, particularly when indoors.
Right. Initially, scientists thought that the coronavirus would spread mainly via droplets, basically things that you spray out as you cough, and also from surfaces. But there's been increasing evidence showing that it can spread as an aerosol. And that's sort of a semantic difference. I mean, a droplet can become an aerosol if it's small enough. But there's an important technical difference for health workers because they take different kinds of health precautions when you're dealing with droplets versus aerosols. And with aerosols, they can linger in the air for hours. Some studies have shown that the virus can still be viable in an airborne aerosol up to 3 hours after it was emitted. What that means is that in an enclosed environment, you can actually still get infected if you go into an area that has stagnant air and has an infectious aerosol.
When we're talking about ventilation systems, what about the ones that people have in their homes? Air conditioning, for example, that isn't, high level air filter quality, but just what do we need to be thinking about?
Right. This is something that does require a bit of a technical fix, and that can be pretty costly and cost prohibitive, especially if you've cranked up the AC already. Running blowers at a higher speed or running air purifiers adds to your energy bill during the hottest part of the day. One thing to pay attention to is the air exchange rate, basically how much air is moving from inside your house to the outside. You want to get that as high as possible. You don't want to simply be recirculating stagnant air inside the house. Things like air purifiers with HEPA filters, those can do a good job of filtering out viruses. And then there's also ultraviolet germicidal sanitation systems that you can install on ventilation systems, but those are, very energy intensive and also very costly. So it will require a significant amount of investment for both households, businesses, and any place where people are going to be gathering in groups to improve the air quality.
What about air pollution? There are cities that are a little bit better at this and cities that are really bad at this, but there's pollution that's out there, and I can't imagine that that's not complicating things here.
Right. Air pollution has been known as now a pretty severe risk factor for COVID-19. Air pollution causes damage to airways, and COVID-19 is a respiratory virus. And so the likely mechanism here is that it takes advantage of that susceptibility. Now, even in hot places in the country where people are spending more time indoors, outdoor air pollution can quickly become indoor air pollution if the houses or the building is not very well insulated or the ventilation system isn't good. And during these periods of extreme heat, you see the greater formation of gases like ozone. Ozone is a major lung irritant, and it forms more readily on hot days. And so you see that sort of a synergistic effect here with both the air pollution and the disease.
Do we know whether or not the air quality issues that we've been talking about have an effect on lower income communities, communities of color, elderly?
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, the same social and, you know, systemic problems that affect minorities and other kinds of communities that are marginalized are at play here. When it comes to air pollution, we tend to find some of the most polluted communities are going to be communities of color and people with lower incomes. But that also holds true for indoor air as well, people who are less likely to have quality insulation to keep outdoor air out or quality ventilation to keep the air inside the home fresh. Also, remember that running all these ventilation systems requires a lot of electricity, which in turn requires a lot of money. And, you know, a lot of homes that may be struggling with, you know, their own finances, particularly in a pandemic like this, may not have the resources or may be trying to weigh the decision of whether to turn on the air conditioning or blowers versus, you know, keeping that off and trying to save money. So those are some difficult decisions, and they are going to be hitting the poorest the most, particularly communities of color, and also the elderly as well, because we know that they are facing higher risks from both the disease and also from heat-related illness.
What role does climate change play in all of this, Amir?
Well, over the long term, we do expect temperatures to rise, and the consequence of that is with heat waves, these periods of extreme heat, those will become more frequent and more intense. And so definitely what we're seeing right now is part of that trend. But the southwest of the U.S. is not the only part of the country that has to worry about heat waves. We're seeing also warmer weather creeping further and further north. And extreme heat in places that are far north can actually be more dangerous because they're not as accustomed to dealing with it. So a place like Seattle that may not have lots of households with air conditioning, a heat wave could have more devastating impacts, even if it doesn't reach as hot as Phoenix, because fewer people have the infrastructure to deal with it.
Umair Irfan is a staff writer at Vox covering climate change and science. Umair, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Despite the COVID-19 crisis we're living through, primary season is continuing across the country. On Tuesday, voters in Alabama, Maine, and Texas weighed in during the Senate primary and runoff races in their states. And how these elections are playing out might give us a sense of whether Democrats actually have a shot at winning control of the Senate in November. For more, I'm joined now by Ella Nilsson, politics and policy reporter for Vox. Ella, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to start here in Alabama. Former football coach Tommy Tuberville won his runoff race against former Attorney General and Senator Jeff Sessions. Now, President Trump endorsed Tuberville over Sessions, who is the president's former Attorney General. Did that endorsement tip the scales for Tuberville?
I think it did. And not only Trump's endorsement, but his vociferous, anti-campaigning against Sessions, who obviously most people remember is his first attorney general and one of his earliest supporters in the 2016 campaign. I think that this race sort of became just a contest over who ultimately was more loyal to the president, and Tuberville came out first in that contest.
So how does this play out against Democrat and incumbent Senator Doug Jones?
I think that either way, whether it was going to be Sessions or Tuberville, Jones is definitely going to have a very uphill battle to keep his seat in the fall. I mean, you have to remember, you know, the fact that he even won the special election for Sessions' old Senate seat, actually, was in the fallout of the Roy Moore allegations of sexual assault and sexual misconduct. But fundamentally, you know, he is a Democrat in a state that is incredibly conservative and really still loves Trump. I mean, Trump's approval rating in that state is still quite high. It's just, you know, fundamentally a very Southern, very conservative state. So whether it was Tuberville or Sessions, you know, Jones was going to have an uphill battle either way. So they're not, you know, they're not trying to do this strategy of hammering Trump's record. They're trying to emphasize his bipartisan support, trying to emphasize his past in the fight for racial justice and his past as a civil rights attorney. So I think that this shows us sort of where the Jones campaign is going to go in the fall, but it's certainly going to be a tough race.
Let's turn to Texas now, where they had a Senate runoff race yesterday, and this one was on the Democratic side. MJ Haggar beat Royce West there. Let's talk a little bit about how Haggar was able to pull that off.
Yeah, I mean, this was a race that got more competitive, I think, than Haggar had anticipated potentially in the last few weeks. And this is sort of a pattern that we've seen in other races as well. So Haggar was a woman Air Force veteran who I think a lot of people remembered. She had this kind of breakout ad in 2018 when she was running for House District. She didn't ultimately win that House District, but the name stuck, and National Democrats approached her to run for the Senate seat against Senator John Cornyn, a Republican. She had to go to a runoff. She didn't win the primary outright earlier in the year. And she was up against Royce West, who is a longtime Black state lawmaker in Texas, a little bit more progressive than Haggar was. And in the wake of, you know, the George Floyd killings in Minneapolis and all of the protests that we have seen around racial inequality and systemic racism in the United States, Royce West got a lot of momentum in Texas. But ultimately, Haggar was the one who was backed by the National Democratic Party and had the fundraising advantage. And it was certainly a closer race than I think a lot of people expected, but she ultimately was able to pull it out.
Ella, a big race that a lot of people were watching here was over in Maine, where the Speaker of the House, Sarah Gideon, won her Democratic primary yesterday. How did Gideon position herself compared to her competitors?
Gideon positioned herself a little bit more in, I would say, a moderate vein, just in the fact that she had two progressive challengers who both fully embraced Medicare for All and a Green New Deal. And I would say, you know, Gideon probably shares a lot of the same goals that they do, but, you know, she, instead of embracing Medicare for All, she has embraced a public option like many of the Democratic Party's backed Senate candidates. And as far as the environment, you know, she supports getting America's greenhouse gas emissions to a manageable target by 2030 or 2050, but she does not support a full, you know, Green New Deal. But I think that, you know, political experts that I talked to in Maine said that Gideon had the support of basically everybody except for a small minority of Bernie Sanders supporters, as one political scientist in Maine told me. You know, she is seen, I think, as far as her tenure in state politics, you know, not a super centrist person. I think that she is seen as somebody who has accomplished some progressive goals in the past. But I think that she is sort of positioning herself more as a pragmatic candidate to go up against Susan Collins.
Well, speaking of Collins, I mean, how are Maine voters feeling about Senator Collins at the moment? She has sort of, I think, disappointed some of her voters occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be by far Susan Collins' toughest reelection that she's had in decades. She's been in the Senate seat for a very long time. She's always positioned herself as a moderate senator, sort of in the vein of, you know, former Senator Olympia Snowe, another moderate woman senator from Maine. And I think that more than anything, this is true for a lot of incumbent Republican senators across the country, but maybe none more so than Collins. You know, she is trying to run on her moderate record, her moderate bipartisan record of getting things done. But at the same time, she is just inextricably linked to Donald Trump, the president, the Republican president, who is going to be at the top of her ticket.
And she's linked, Ella, because she has supported the president in some pretty key moments. While sort of attempting to toe that line of being a moderate, there have been moments where Senator Collins has really pretty outwardly supported the president.
Absolutely. You're right. I mean, she most notably on her vote for Brett Kavanaugh in the Supreme Court confirmation, certainly the GOP tax bill. There are a lot of things where, you know, she has sort of publicly waffled and, you know, so said, sort of drawn out a lot of suspense on how she is going to vote, and ultimately has voted and sided with the president. And as far as the Kavanaugh issue, I mean, if she was sort of hoping that would go away in people's minds, you know, he recently sided with anti-abortion groups in a recent decision. So that just is still going in people's minds, certainly. So, you know, Collins is trying to run again on her bipartisan record. But I think it is going to be sort of the specter of Trump hanging over her is going to make it extremely challenging this time.
Of course, we mentioned at the very top that we are still living in a COVID-19 world, and I'm wondering whether the coronavirus affected voter turnout at all. Is it too early to tell?
So at least in Texas, there were local reports that Democratic turnout was actually was hitting records. So and in Texas, there was a lot of in-person voting, as well as a little less mail-in ballots. So far, I think, you know, it's still tough to tell. I think in Maine and in Alabama, folks are still tabulating the absentee ballots that are coming in. So it's hard to get sort of the full picture of turnout. But I think that, you know, the underlying theme is that Democrats are still very energized to get out and vote this year. And this could be a preview for what we're going to see come November.
Ella Nilsen is a politics and policy reporter for Vox. Ella, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's great to have you with us. There are a lot of different voices in the national conversation about policing in the United States and how to make it better. Recently, The Takeaway convened five people in law enforcement, advocacy, and academia, and asked them to come together to talk about the way forward. In an hour-long forum hosted on Facebook, we tackled what's broken in today's system and what it would take to fix it, and we answered questions from the thousands who tuned in. Today, we're bringing you excerpts of that conversation. In this first section, you'll hear from Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo, retired NYPD Detective Mark Claxton, and Janae Nelson, Associate Director Counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And Janae told me that she wants the public to know just how much money we invest in police departments and law enforcement agencies and why that matters.
It is a representation of our values. It is a representation of societal investments. And what we're doing to the tune of $270 million a year, back if you look at 2018, is investing federal funds in enforcement agencies. That's just federal funding. It doesn't even speak to the local and state funding that we invest in local law enforcement. And what that does is divest money from education, social services, from all sorts of supports that could in fact ensure that crime is decreased, that could in fact ensure that our society has a better social safety net, that can bring about the public safety and service and care that all residents of this country deserve. Instead, we are expanding not only through actual dollars, but through the redeployment of military equipment and in-kind donation to over 18,000 law enforcement agencies across the country. So we're funding them in multiple ways. And in the New York City circumstance, the budget last year was $6 billion, and there's been $1 billion removed from the upcoming budget. But no one knows exactly where those funds will be reinvested. Will they be reinvested in agencies that we can be certain will make a difference in communities? It is an important first step. It is an important symbolic act, but much more needs to be done to examine the outsized role of law enforcement in communities across the country.
Mark, at the top of this forum, you mentioned the different types of issues that we're seeing in police departments, and one of them was militarization of the actual the police themselves. And I can say that I covered the aftermath of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, for the New York Times, and witnessed for my very self the tanks that were coming down the street, the tear gas, and all of these other things that I think many people never imagined they would see. How do you pull back on militarization of the police? I mean, where do you even begin to pull back on that so we can move forward?
Well, I think it's important for people to keep in mind that actual Defense Department program was implemented in 97 under the Clinton administration. And really, initially, the military equipment was supposed to be used in the ongoing effort to eradicate drugs in our community. So if you can imagine, that didn't go too well. the expansion of that program since that time has created a scenario where you have police departments that have now deep reliance on the use of the military equipment in the civilian space, which is totally inappropriate and increases the level of danger. How you go about changing that is that you restrict the allocation of those equipment items and you make demands that these police agencies identify specifically what the need is and what the use of these equipment items will be. But I think more important, what you have to do is to defund the ability of agencies to bring into a civilian space this heavy duty military equipment, you know, these things that are just not necessary in the scope. And what you do when you put military equipment on the street in the police capacity is that you make a clear delineation. It's us against them. It's the us against the enemy. And the community picks up on that, responds and reacts to that, and feels as if they are being invaded, when in fact what policing should be about is protecting and serving. So just the use of the military equipment is very problematic and should be eradicated moving forward.
Chief Acevedo, you mm-hmm. have been mm-hmm. very vocal about the need for police reform, but I'm wondering, you said that you've gotten rid of a couple of bushels of bad apples, not just the occasional quote-unquote bad apple, but what are the conversations that you're having in this moment with the officers that work under you, who are probably watching this moment and interpreting it in many different ways? There are some folks who are saying the police are under siege. How are you communicating this need for change to your officers?
Well, first of all, I let them know that history is watching. They're watching everything that we're doing, and that this is our moment in time in history, this generation of police officer, to move the ball forward. And how we respond today will define our generation of cops and police leadership for generations to come. And so I tell them that adversity actually is taken as an opportunity to engage in lifting up good policing by doing everything we can to get rid of the bad bushels of police officers. And I can tell you that, at least for my city and in this department, the vast majority of our people support it. As a matter of fact, I've been here for only 3.5 years. I've unfortunately had to run off quite a few people, and it touches my heart when I have officers who will come up to me from a shift that's worth 2 28-year veterans that have been, quite frankly, thorns in the side of everybody for a long time, get run out. This generation of cop, a lot of them are actually coming forward and say, thank you. Thank you for finally doing something about it. So we don't want our officers to run away from this. We want our officers to recognize the history of policing is ugly. There's still a lot of ugliness in policing, and they truly are part of the solution. But I got to push back a little bit on the militarization piece, because it's not about the equipment. It's about the proper use of the equipment, the circumstances, the policy in the use of the equipment, and the proper supervision, command, and control. For example, Dayton, Ohio, when we had a suspect murdered 9 people in an active shooter last year. He was about to go into a nightclub or a bar crowded with people with a 100-round drum and an assault rifle, and it was a police officer with a patrol rifle that was able to stop that man from killing people, or the MRAPs that people think are tanks. We have used those during hurricanes to rescue people. So again, we've got to be real careful that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater and that we don't paint with broad brushes. It's truly about leadership. It's about accountability. It's about proper training, proper policy, and proper oversight from the communities that we serve.
Would anyone want to respond to that about the militarization, the fact that it could be? Go ahead, Mark.
Well, it's just I think what tends to happen is it's sort of like giving a kid sugar. Once you give them the sugar, they become addicted to the sugar. They believe that they cannot exist without the sugar. And I think in law enforcement, because they've been exposed and allowed to utilize this equipment, now it's become vitally important. And I have a question, because I mean, I have some years of experience in the police department. I wonder how we did it before there was military and defense equipment that was allocated to the police departments. I wonder how we did it before there was a tank rolling through the street. I think we have to really kind of weigh and say, listen, is it more useful or more detrimental to our development and establishing and cultivating relationships in the community to have tanks marching, rolling down the street? Now, you can call it, it's MRAP, I understand that, but But is it useful? Is it something that we can't do without? Or has it gotten to the point where now we're over-relying on this military equipment? And I think it's the latter. I think we're over-relying on it and not recognizing what that symbolizes and means to a community. It means we're under siege, we are the enemy, and we are being not served and protected here.
Janae, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I also wanted to add that we have to think about whose hands we're putting this military equipment in. And when we think back to the fact that the FBI identified back in 2006 that police departments are being infiltrated by white nationalist organizations, we must rethink how we are empowering police forces without the appropriate screening, without the appropriate training. And we also know that to suggest that military equipment is only used, and I'm not suggesting that Police Chief Acevedo said this, but others may think that we only use military equipment in the most dire circumstances where we're preventing mass shootings or we're preventing the loss of mass civilian life. And that's simply not the case. We are seeing military equipment deployed against protesters who are exercising their constitutional right to peaceful assembly and free speech. And they are met with officers in riot gear, in tanks, and using ballistic style missiles. That just can't be the way this country operates, particularly when you add the overlay of the type of officers that are being let into police departments without sufficient screening and without sufficient oversight and accountability. So we can't isolate one piece of this and suggest that that piece is a safety mechanism for American society at large if we don't examine many of the corrosive features that exist within law enforcement agencies. And to give military equipment to officers and law enforcement agencies that have such massive structural problems is an extraordinarily dangerous thing, not only to individuals and communities, but also to our democracy at large.
We've talked about militarization and the use of that technology, but there are other technologies that police departments around the country, and some of us have alluded to that in this forum, are implementing and have been implementing for the past couple of years. There was a big push for this, particularly under the Obama administration, to increase the use of data collection and technology within police departments. I'm specifically referring to things like SpotShotter, which allows police departments to isolate where and when gunshots are heard, body cameras, which we're all very familiar with at this point, predictive policing, which is the use of data to predict behavior. Some of these were supposed to be an answer to police accountability. Rashad, how are they working out?
Well, they're not working out. There are reforms around the edges that don't actually deal with the structural sort of challenges that we have. And a structural challenge is that video alone does not lead to accountability if we don't have the mechanisms to actually create accountability. And while the movement has, I think, exacted some accountability when a video has appeared, it shouldn't take people taking to the streets to protest to get someone who shoots or puts their knee on someone on camera and to get arrested, to be charged. And that's exactly where we're sort of at, you know, in all of this. And so I think time and time again, I absolutely understand and appreciate the sort of energy and focus at wanting to figure out a way to make this work, at wanting to figure out if we can just add body cameras, we can like reduce crime, we can reduce police misconduct by this percentage point. If we just ban chokeholds, we can like make things better. If police are right now not engaged in our communities and in a project of safety, but a project of control, then what ends up happening is that control becomes the bottom line. And that is what we are experiencing time and time again. And I know this is sometimes hard for people to want to see because our media tells us a story about policing, our culture tells us a story about safety and policing, and we want to believe that we can just fix this and make this work. We could just add new technologies on problematic systems and make it work, but that doesn't work in any industry. If the banks are not working and if the banks are exploiting and targeting Black people, giving them new technology will make them just target and exploit us in new and creative ways. And so I am not against new technology at all as a person who like leverages technology to supercharge social change. What I believe is that you can't just overlay technology if you don't change the structures and the systems at the heart of the problem. And that means that we have to fundamentally downsize policing in this country, and we have to put our money and resources in things that actually ensure that our communities are safe.
Phil, can you help us connect the dots between the behavior changes you say we need, the technology that's being implemented and has been implemented, and how do we use those two things to move forward and create the reform that we're talking about today?
Okay, so I think it's really important. A lot of things that Rashad has been saying are just dead on. I want to amplify them. There's one element of this, which is in many cities across the country, there was no such thing as formal law enforcement until there was property that had two legs and could learn to read and write. Mm-hmm. Right? And then after that, there were formally racist laws, and it was law enforcement's job to enforce formal racism. And at no point in this country's history did we say, hey, that stuff that we did that was super racist and the group of people that we gave that job to, we should do something entirely different. There has not been a full accounting for the previous mission of law enforcement and the evolution to the present. Now, that doesn't mean that current law enforcement are just slave catchers, right? I hear that. I see that. That's not at all what I'm saying. But there needs to be a break between the past mission and the current mission. That needs to be formalized so we can be clear. The mission should be public safety. That's one part of the project. We need to really, literally reimagine, well, what are the levers that we give so that folks don't have to call police in the first place, right? What are the set of options that we give to communities so that they have resources to handle it themselves or so that they can call someone to deal with substance abuse who doesn't come in with a badge and a gun? And at the same time, we need to be engaged in changing whoever is given that job, right, and whatever the mission is, so that what they're doing isn't harmful. And I just have to push back on the idea that under the Obama administration, there was a move towards using data, and that was towards predictive policing, right? Like, that's just, there are a whole bunch of different things that were listed there that are different elements of what different folks have been trying to do. Predictive policing is not part of the pro-equity movements inside of law enforcement. Predictive policing is an attempt to get more accurate at who's committing the crimes, but because of the way that artificial intelligence works, which is artificial intelligence is just human intelligence supercharged, the biases are often baked in, and the attempts to try and remove those biases have not involved communities, right? So there's that. Body cameras have never seen a moment when the struggle for Black liberation has been aided by more state surveillance, right? So it's not the case that all of these things go together, and also on top of that, these things were never funded at a level that allowed for scale. They were never funded so Janae talked about the $270 million the federal government puts in. That's on top of $115 billion that get put in at the state and local level. And at best, police reforms inside of law enforcement are funded at $10, $15 million a year. That's not going to get the kind of change that we're talking about. So what I'm hoping we're going to leave the takeaway, if you will, from today is at the same time that we're interrogating the mission of law enforcement and how to right size on public safety while we're giving the resources to Black communities that have been defunded for generations, we also have to do the yes and of actually scaling the things we know work inside of law enforcement to make them less deadly, to make them less racist. And that's not just
what data are some of those training. Things, Phil?
That's exactly. So that's the actual cultural elements of this. So, right, Chief Acevedo said that culture eats policy for breakfast. He's absolutely right. The reason why folks have been focusing on data is because law enforcement is a data-driven industry. Law enforcement goes out at the behest of CompStat all the time. Where's the crime? That's where we're supposed to go. But we've been measuring crime in law enforcement for the last quarter century, and we haven't been measuring justice. Right. If we did that, then you could say, you know what, over there, stop beating people up. Over there, right, stop hassling the folks who are on the corners and talk to the people who know where violence is actually occurring. If we measured the things that actually mattered, we could make law enforcement more aligned with community values at the same time that we're trying to adjust the mission or radically change the mission to align with community values. It's got to be in everything. Situation now. It can't be this or that, and that false dichotomy is absolutely going to end up undermining the moment that we've got and end up with a huge backlash 5 years from now. Remember that the rise in mass incarceration came precisely at the moment when the entirety of American culture was saying, you know what, we think we've gotten this wrong. We think we've gotten inclusion wrong. It was the backlash to that that led to the largest incarceration of humanity in human history. So I just want to make sure that we're thinking long haul on this and we're not just thinking short term.
That was an excerpt of a recent Takeaway Forum on the Future of Policing with psychologist Dr. Philip Atiba Goff, who you just heard there, along with Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change, Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo, retired NYPD detective Mark Claxton, and Janae Nelson, associate director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. And there's lots more to this conversation, and you can find that in its entirety at thetakeaway.org. And lots more on police reform for us to talk about on the show. Tell us what you want to hear when it comes to the future of policing in America. We're at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and that's our show for today. I'm Tanzina Vega. Talk to you tomorrow here on The Takeaway.